सार्थिमर्जुनस्य आदौ कुर्वन् गीतामृतं ददौ लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्ण। वेलकम टु द भगवद्गीता चाप्टर् टू। सो एट् द एण्ड् आफ़् द चाप्टर् वन् अर्जुन हेस् पुट् असैड् इस् बो विसृज्य सशरं चापं शोकसंविघ्नमानसः। He is holding his head in his hands, his head is lowered. And he is shokasamvigna, his mind is filled with misery. Manasaha, shokasamvigna, with moroseness, with lamentation. And he has told through his actions to Krishna that I will not fight. So that is the end of the Arjun Vishada Yoga. Now the second chapter starts. Second chapter has been named differently by different acharyas. Sankhya Yoga is one of the standard names because Sankhya is what is talked about at least in the initial part of the chapter. And Sankhya essentially involves analysis of existence into various elements. So the analysis of the existence into basically matter and spirit, into our life, into body and soul, our being, into material and spiritual sides. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur has said that the second chapter has the whole Gita in a nutshell. And that's why he uses the name Contents of the Gita Summarized. So Prabhupada uses that name for the second chapter. Let's look at the overview of the second chapter. And then we will move forward. So the sections can be divided into five. The first section is Arjuna's further doubts and surrender. So Arjuna expresses one more reason, that is indecision. And he feels, because I am undecided, so let me just not take the more aggressive course of action, let me not fight. Then in Krishna, he is basically using various reasonings to Arjuna for fighting. So first to the 11 to 30, he says jnana. What is jnana? That is knowledge. Fight. So using jnana, fight. As the soul is eternal, compassion for the temporary body is ignorant and useless. So here he counters Arjuna's compassion argument. First argument was, oh, how can I kill my relatives? He felt compassionate for them. Second argument was based on enjoyment. So in 31 to 38 is Karmakanda. So that is the first application of Atmajnana. Atmajnana is I am not the body and the soul. So when you understand that you are not the body or the soul, that means you will continue to live after you die also. And if you act according to dharma, then you will get elevated destination, go to Swarga. By doing your prescribed duties, you will enjoy. So dharma has to be done to get kama and artha. So therefore, he says that if you want to enjoy also, only by doing dharma you will enjoy. And in this way, he counters Arjuna's enjoyment argument. And then, further, the third argument is about Nishkam Karma Yoga. So in the Nishkam Karma Yoga argument, Krishna basically focuses on Arjuna's concern that there will be suffering because Arjuna will be subjected to sinful reactions. So Krishna tells him that if you act in Nishkam Karma Yoga, then you will be doing activity which will bring no reaction. And when there is no reaction, then there is no sinful reaction also. So that's the next part. So in Nishkam Karma Yoga, that is the second application of Atmajnana. It's one level higher. If you really understand you are the soul, then the goal is not to go to Swarga. The goal is to go beyond material existence to eternal spiritual existence. And for that, be not attached to anything material. So fight with detachment, then there will be no sinful reactions. So this counters Arjuna's sinful reactions argument. And then when he is talking about a person who is detached from everything material, for that Arjuna asks, who is that kind of person? I want to know more about that person. Then Krishna gives the characteristics of that person. And there, that is the last section, characteristic of a sthita pragya. So basically, in this section, Arjuna's three arguments, compassion, enjoyment and sinful reactions, is in one way countered. Now the argument about kulakshaya pranashyanti, the destruction of family tradition, will be countered in the third chapter. And Arjuna's next last fifth argument is indecision, which he will make in this chapter. That will be countered by the end of the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna expresses his decision. He gives up indecision, expresses his decision, I will fight. So let's look at the chapter now. It starts with Sanjay Vacha Tam Tatha Kripaya Vishtam अशुपूर्णा कुलेक्षणं विशीदन्तमिदं वाक्यं उवाच मधुसूदनः सो तं तथा कृपयाविष्टम् तम एंड टू दैट पर्सन हु इज दैट पर्सन द प्रीवियस चैप्टर एंडेड विद द डिस्क्रिप्शन ऑफ अर्जुना अर्जुना हैड सैट डाउन सो एंड टू दैट तथा कृपयाविष्टम सो दैट अर्जुना हु हैड दस सैट डाउन ओवरकम बाय कृपया बाय वीकनेस वीकनेस कॉज बाय कंपैशन सो अश्रु पूर्ण अकुलेक्षण सो इक्षण इज आईज पूर्ण अकुल अश्रु पूर्ण फुल ऑफ टीयर्स दैट मीन्स नॉट जस्ट अ फ्यू टीयर्स but the tears are filling the eyes practically speaking if you consider the eyes to be containers then the container was overflowing and the tears were coming out vishidantam idam vakyam vishidantam means he was lamenting at that time these words vacha madhusudana so that lord madhusudana he spoke these words so now Srila Prabhupada because this is a sankhya yoga chapter where there's a difference between the body and the soul So Srila Prabhupada takes the focuses in this chapter on the point that actually bodily emotions are illusory. So in the previous chapter, the focus was on talking about Arjuna's qualities. And that's why Prabhupada said that yes, Arjuna is thoughtful, he is saintly, he doesn't want to hurt others. In all these ways, he's talking about the good qualities of Arjuna. But now he's going to talk about the bodily conception and Prabhupada starts itself with a very sutra-like statement material compassion lamentation and tears are all signs of ignorance of the real self compassion for the eternal soul is self-realization that's two distinct points Prabhupada makes which are related but they're substantially different also first is ignorance of the real self so when we are ignorant Then there is material compassion, the lamentation and tears. So which is what Arjuna has exhibited. Where are these three words coming from? These are coming from what is talked about in the verse. Kripaya, kripaya paraya vishtam. That is material compassion. Then there is vishidantam. That is lamentation. And ashrupurna kulekshanam. That is tears. So these three are coming up. And Prabhupada is saying all this indicates the ignorance of the true self. And if the true self is known, and if one wants to be compassionate, how is one compassionate to the true self? By cultivating self-realization. By cultivating self-realization. So compassion for the eternal soul is self-realization. That means, actually, the person doesn't have to be hard-hearted if the person wants to be spiritually knowledgeable. It just says that we have to direct the soft-heartedness in the right avenue. So when we are ignorant, if somebody is coughing and we think, oh, the person is coughing, what should I do? The cough causes so much pain. So if somebody says, oh, the person is coughing, just stuff the person's mouth with a hanky, then he will not cough. Well, that is, you may want the person not cough, but that is ignorant. That is not going to solve the problem of coughing. Actually, we have to take the person to a doctor and then give the proper medicine and the coughing will stop. So when we see somebody coughing, naturally we feel, if somebody comes for coughing very badly, we feel compassion for that person. But compassion has to be directed in an intelligent and knowledgeable way, not an ignorant way. So same way, with respect to the suffering of material existence, when we see death, when we see old age, when we see destruction, we naturally feel bad about it. But we have to have it in a direct those resulting feelings of compassion properly. So that is actually. The person is suffering, but this person is suffering because of bodily misidentification. There may be some specific causes of suffering right now which do need to be dealt with. But beyond that, the person is fundamentally suffering because of ignorance of the soul. So that ignorance has to be countered. And the way that ignorance is countered is by becoming self-realized. So that's why compassion for the self is self-realization. For the eternal soul is self-realization. So actually when we are chanting Hare Krishna, we are being compassionate. Compassionate to ourselves, compassionate to others. That is self-realization. And Prabhupada of course used the word Madhusudana and he says, Madhu, here Krishna just says Krishna is the killer of demons. So then Sanjay is indicating through the use of the word Madhusudana that this Lord who killed the demon will now kill the demon of doubt, the demon of indecision, the demon of delusion that has overcome Arjuna. So that's the indication of this particular word. After describing this, now Krishna, these are the first words, full words that Krishna is speaking. He has spoken just pasya, Partha Pashyaitan. Just see, that is the only word that Arjuna Krishna spoke in the earlier chapter. Now he starts speaking. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Kutastva Kashmalavidam Vishame Samupasthitam Anarajushtam Asvargyam Akirtikaram Arjuna. So, Krishna is surprised over here. He says, Kutastva, where from? Kashmalamidam, that such contamination has come upon you. Kashmala is contamination. Vishame samupasthitam, vishame. Vishama means at a critical moment. Critical moment. How have you become so weak-minded? So, anarajushtam asvargyam. This does not befit you. Anarajushtam. You are a glorious person. So, sometimes, you know, if there is a big sporting event, say there is a World Cup final, and the last over is coming, and then the bowler is about to bowl, and the bowler starts trembling. How can I bowl? What will happen in this hole? The captain says, come on, you are made of better stuff. You can't lose your nerve like this. So people who lose their nerve, you know, sometimes they are called as chokers. You choke when the pressure comes up. When the pressure comes up, a person should be able to take the pressure. That's maturity. That's a person who can choke, take the pressure is said to be cool. But somebody who can't take the pressure is said to choke, so a person gets choked up. So Krishna is telling Arjuna, don't be a choker like that. So nobody likes the label of a choker. You know, people feel that when the pressure comes, I'll be able to take the pressure. So Krishna is telling Anarajushtam Asvargyam, Anarya, this Vishame Samupasthitam. This is a crisis moment, this is a pressure moment. And at that time, the real stuff should come out. The real strong you should come out. But what is this? I am saying Anarajushtam, this doesn't become you. So Kutastva. From where has such a feeling come about? This is unexpected for you. Now the words have special significance over here. Anarajushtam asvargam akirtikaram Arjuna. So he is saying that this action is unbefitting for you in three ways. What are three ways? It is unbecoming for you as Arya. It is unbecoming for you because asvargam, it will not take you to auspicious destination. And also akirtikaram, even in this world, it will make not bring you fame but infamy. So, it does not befit who you are. It does not befit what you will get in the future, next life. It does not befit what you will get in this life also. So, in every way, this action is unworthy of you. Now, what is the word Arya? Now, we have a very positive connotation of the word Arya. Say, the word Arya, there is a particular society which is called Arya Samaj. And they have the idea that Aryans are a particular kind of people. Historically, it is said that Aryans was a very advanced race. Srila Prabhupada acknowledges all this, but he says these are all external meanings. The essential meaning of the word Arya, when Krishna is using it, he is not referring to it, oh, you don't belong to a particular race. Then Prabhupada says Arya refers to those who know the purpose of life, who know spiritual purpose of life, who have spiritual values. They are Aryas. So, today the word Arya has a very negative connotation in Western thought, as well as that thought has come to India also. Basically, you know, words acquire certain meanings based on how they are used. And the word Arya has become almost like in today's intellectual dialogue, discourse, it has become like an untouchable word. Nobody wants to use that word to identify themselves. Just like nobody wants to be called a fanatic. Religious fanatic, that's probably the worst label that a person can get today. You are a right-wing extremist. So like that, the word Arya has got a lot of negative connotation. In fact, you know, associated with Vedic culture, there was this also, we have the swastik. So there was an attempt in Germany to get the swastik banned, because swastik itself has associations which bring very unpleasant memories for certain people. So the word Arya has not been banned, but it has also become like that. So why is that? Prabhupada explains, beyond any racial, cultural connotations, he says the Arya has a spiritual connotation, spiritual meaning. That is, that it refers to the person who has spiritual values. That person is Arya. Now, words have two features. There is denotation and there is connotation. Denotation means what the word directly means. Connotation means what it implies. So, when we use words, we have to be aware of both. For example, we discussed earlier the word gay. The word gay, denotation, 50 years ago, it was just simply the cheerful. But now the word gay has a completely different meaning. So, like that, now of course, that words have certain meanings and they have certain subtle associations when the words are used. So, the word, what is the problem with the word Arya? So actually, when the Europeans came to India, they discovered after Columbus, after Vasco da Gama came to India, basically Europe was divided into Catholics and Protestants. So there are two main divisions from the 15th, 16th century onwards between the church and Spain, Portugal and Italy. These were the countries which were under the Catholic Church. And France, Germany, Britain, they were all under Protestants. So they had their own churches, Anglican Church and other churches. But there's a split. And both of them felt that we should evangelize the world. Evangelize means we should spread the gospel of Christianity everywhere. So the Protestants went to America. Amerigo Vespucci and Columbus went there. Then Vasco da Gama came to India. Now, and of course, primarily Italy and Spain, they were under Catholics. So then after that, so they went to South America. And then there were the Catholics and Protestant wars were going on in Europe, and similarly in the colonial territories also where wars were going on. But eventually Britain, which was a Protestant country, it got paramountcy, it got power over India. And then when they came to India, initially they found that this culture is so majestic. They first thought that everybody apart from Christians must be very barbaric people. And Rudyard Kipling even wrote a poem. His poem was that, it is the white man's burden to civilize the rest of society, rest of the world. So he says, just like it's a father, it's a father's responsibility to grow the child, to educate the child. So he said that the whole rest of the world is uncivilized, it's primitive, uncultured. And it is the white man's burden to civilize the rest of society, rest of the world. So they had their own superiority complex, that we are the best in the world. And of course, they had science and technology, which added to their infatuation. So when they came to India, they were shocked to see that India had its own magnificent literature and a lofty vision of history, which spanned far, far greater than their history. For Europe, all the doors of history ultimately go to Greece. And there is Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and something beyond that, but primarily Greek civilization was considered very advanced, and after that Jesus came and Jesus redeemed everything. So that was the idea. But the Vedic civilization went thousands and thousands of years beyond. And initially they thought this was a very primitive civilization, but as some of them started looking at Sanskrit literature and saw the scope of it, they were stunned. And somehow their superiority complex couldn't digest the idea that there can be any civilization which is more advanced than our civilization. So then they tried to come up with various ideas, how can we accept this? You know, then basically they found that there was a lot of similarity also. For example, the Monier Williams and Max Müller and all these other prominent Indologists, that means Western European scholars who studied India. The branch of knowledge which studies India is called as Indology. So, of course, it involves philosophy, it can involve language, it can involve religious studies, it can involve anthropology, various fields can be there in that. But the broad branch is called as Indology. So now, all these people when they studied, they found that Sanskrit was remarkably similar to Latin and Greek. But not only was it similar, it was actually better. Sanskrit was more refined, the vocabulary was better, and the structure, the grammar structure and the aesthetics was also better. So, the grammar is for techniques, and we have figures of speech, we have metaphors, literary devices, that is for aesthetics. So the techniques and aesthetics of Sanskrit both were superior to Latin and Greek. And now this was even more difficult for them to digest. So then a logical inference, if Sanskrit is superior to both, then one inference could be that why is the similarity there? Because they are all related, and Sanskrit is superior, but Sanskrit is more advanced. And then probably there was some old civilization from which there are offshoots. And so some offshoots went to Europe. And that's how European civilization came about. But this was unacceptable to their superiority complex. You know, that means these barbarians, so they had the idea, we are civilized people, rest of the world is barbarian. So these barbarians, they are our source. and they have a civilization better than us, that they just couldn't accept. So they came up with their own theory that, okay, the European civilization and the Indian civilization both have evolved from some other civilization. And that civilization they called as the Aryan civilization. And they had the Aryans came from somewhere, they came and civilized Europe, and they came and civilized India also. Now, this was not just to explain away the magnificence of Indian culture. That was one aspect, but there was a political it was not just to justify their superiority. There was a political agenda behind this also. See, when the Muslims came and ruled India, the Muslims came and started staying in India. So numerous Muslims came and stayed in India, and a lot of Muslims, Indians also got converted also. But anyway, the Muslims, when they came, for example, Akbar, their intention was to rule. They stayed in India. Akbar, Babar, from Babar onwards. India became their home. But for the Britishers, you know, India was like a degraded land. And for most Britishers, they felt that going to India is like a punishment. You know, for some officer is posted in India. It's India is such a primitive, dirty, uncultured place. To be posted there is like a punishment. So they didn't want to stay there. But at the same time, they wanted to maintain their rule here. So they decided the only way we can rule India, if Indians don't cooperate with our rule, we'll not be able to rule them. So the only way we can rule India is if Indians voluntarily accept that we are superior to them. That we are superior to them and that we will teach them and we are there for their help. Not to rule them, but to help them. Then they will accept our rule. So then how do you make Indians accept their rule? So from the Indian point of view, if Indians are going to study, look at them from the Vedic scripture point of view, and people who eat meat, people who drink alcohol, people who are not following the basic principles of life, regular principles, now they are considered low class. So how can they be respected? So of course they had the power of science and technology, which brought some respect, and they were political rulers, which also brought some respect. But that respect was a grudging respect, and that was not a willing respect. So then they felt that the only way we can make them respect us is if they see that our culture is superior to theirs. And if that is to be done, then their framework for evaluating cultural superiority has to be changed. And for that purpose, they decided, it was a huge program which has gone on over multiple generations. They decided that, you know, people's faith, Indians' faith in the Vedic literature has to be destroyed. When that faith is destroyed, then they will not see us through the framework of those eyes, through that script, those cultural standards. And they will see our superiority. So when the Muslims came to India, they destroyed temples. Many temples they destroyed. Thousands, in fact. But when the Britishers came to India, they did not destroy so many temples. Their strategy was much deeper. They destroyed the faith that made people go to the temples. By misinterpreting the Vedic literature in a systematic way, they destroyed the faith. So one of the ideas was that rather than acknowledging that Indian culture is Indian literature, Indian culture is superior to European culture, they said, both of us, we have come from some other culture. And that they call as Aryan civilization. So in that sense, we are both long lost brothers. You know, our ancestors are the same. They are the ancient Aryans, and we have both come from the same ancestors. And now long lost brothers have met. And now that we have met, we have learned some things more, so we'll teach them to you. So, and that original Aryan culture that is lost. So practically, everything that was good about Indian culture, they said, oh, that has not come from India. That has come from that Aryan civilization. And the original Indians, they were the Dravidians. Dravidians, they were low caste, low quality people. And of course, it's a very complex socio-political issue. So I'll not go into the intricacies. Our focus here is on the current untouchable status that is associated with the word Aryan. Why is that? So what happened was that this idea, so one of Srila Prabhupada's scholar disciples, Devamrit Maharaj, has written the book Searching for Vedic India, where he talks extensively about this. And this is a huge field of academic research also. So basically, when the idea came up that there was an ancient civilization, which is the mother, which is the parent of both the European civilization, the Greco-Roman civilization, and the Indian civilization. Then the quest for that ancient motherland became frantic. Now, where was it? The problem is that if there was the ancient civilization and that was so advanced that it led to all the good parts of the Indian civilization and all the good parts of the European civilization, also, then it itself must have been very advanced. Where is that civilization? And actually, archaeology and history all around in the Eurasia, or for that matter, in that whole area, they couldn't give any tangible evidence for ancient advanced civilization anywhere else. So, now the correct understanding is that actually that ancient civilization was in India itself. And after the Kurukshetra war, then people started, when the strong rule of at Hastinapur over India and the world started weakening, then there was emigration and then there was disconnection. And that's how there were expatriates who went from here everywhere else. So the point was that actually the heartland of the Aryan civilization was in India only. And Aryans and Dravidians, they were living compatibly together. And this whole division is actually quite artificial. There were so many races over there in India at that time also. Different people were living reasonably harmoniously. But this idea came up that Aryans were staying somewhere else. And that way, you know, Indians could be deprived of the credit for their advanced civilization. Because this is not yours, this is the Aryan civilization. All the good parts. Sanskrit has come from the Aryans. Now, if there's Aryans were invading tribes who came, there's several problems. First is, there is no archaeological evidence for any advanced civilization anywhere in Eurasia. Beyond that, if you think the Aryans were just nomadic tribes, that was the idea. You know, they were tribes who were nomadic, means traveling here and there. Now, these nomadic tribes sang the Rig Veda, that is the idea. So now Rig Veda and Sanskrit itself, Rig Veda itself is a complex poetry, and Sanskrit is such a profound language that even the understanding the grammar of Sanskrit takes 12 years. So then the question comes up, if there was a race which is primarily nomadic, you know, people who are just traveling, how much time do they have to study? If they don't even have one place to stay, then they are always on the move. When can they study and how much can they study? If you look at the anthropology of the world, anthropology is study of the cultures of the world, and we see that generally nomadic people don't develop much literature. Their language is not very sophisticated. Even their thoughts, they may have wisdom because of traveling, but in terms of literary sophistication and linguistic depth, that's not possible for nomadic tribes. You know, we have some idea of this. When say some preachers and somebody over there traveling a lot, then you may can read a few books while traveling, because now traveling is easy. We can travel by cars, we can travel by trains, we can travel by planes. But earlier, when people would travel, you had to travel on horseback, or you had to walk, or you had to travel by some other animal, using some other draught animals. So then, that sort of traveling is not very conducive for reading. So then, and what about systematic serious studying? So there's a complete mismatch between the idea that there are these nomadic tribes who is going from place to place to place, and they're writing and speaking and singing in a language whose grammar takes 12 years to master. So basically the point is the Aryan invasion theory or the Aryan migration theory, that is a complete speculation. It's a total mess and there is practically no evidence for it. But anyway, the idea was once this claim of an ancient civilization which populated the Europe as well as populated and civilized both Europe and India came up, then almost every European country started claiming, oh, we are that ancient civilization, we are that ancient civilization. And one person who claimed that we are that ancient civilization is Adolf Hitler. So Hitler got the idea that Germans are the original Aryans. And Germans are the people who have actually civilized the whole world. And now that ancient glory of Germany will now come back again. So under me. So his idea was that because Germans were the original glorious race of the world, they deserve to rule the world. And this Aryan idea was one of the prominent ideas of the Nazi ideology. And through that he poisoned the whole world, whole of German country. And then that poison spread practically all over the whole world. And eventually he started attacking country after country, and this whole Second World War started because the Nazis were convinced of their superiority over others based on the conception of they being the original Aryans. And then he also adopted the swastika. So the swastika symbol is there. So he said that we are the Aryans. We Germans are descended from the Aryans. And the swastika, that is the symbol of auspiciousness, he twisted it around and he said this is our symbol. So of course he wanted not auspiciousness for everyone, he wanted inauspiciousness for everyone, practically inauspicious for everyone except the Germans. So either they have to be slaves of Germans, subordinate to Germans, or they have to be exterminated. So eventually, of course, the World War II took place and finally he was checked and he committed suicide and then everything stopped. The war stopped after that in 1944-45. But the point of all this discussion is that the word Arya became associated with the whole socio-political mess that erupted as the Second World War. And that's why now nobody wants to say that we are the Arya, because Hitler was to claim that I was the Arya. And the word has got a very negative connotation today. So the point is, all these are completely they are accretions. Accretions means that which is externally added. They are irrelevant to the context of the Bhagavad Gita. When Bhaktisiddhanta Sri Thakur sent his disciples to preach, so they went to, there are two countries which were very influential. England was influential and Germany was influential in Europe at that time. So America was also powerful, but America became especially powerful after the Second World War. So Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur, at that time Europe was still powerful. In fact, so he had sent his disciples to both Britain and Germany. And while his disciples were preaching in Germany, so one of his disciples gave a talk about Aryans. And then he mentioned the point that actually this Aryan is a spiritual designation. And this is not a racial designation. It doesn't refer so much to a particular race. It refers to the person having spiritual values. And then one of the Nazis, he read this and he found this unacceptable. And he said this is completely antithetical to the understanding of Aryans that we have. And at that time they were in power, and they said that they said that the Gaudiya Math, what they are preaching, is completely poisonous. It's completely antithetical to understanding. This sort of understanding should not be given. And they almost imposed a ban on the devotees preaching over there. And the devotees were preaching over there, they had to. These devotees were, at that time, ISKCON was not there. These are Gaudiya Math devotees, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur disciples. They had to flee for their life. And somehow the whole German mission got scuttled. So the point is, this is not just a casual thing, what the word Arya means and what it does not mean. It has very serious implications. So here what Krishna is referring to, Anarya, is a person who does not act according to spiritual values. That is Anarya. Anarajushtam asvargyam akirtikaram arjuna. So akirtikaram will be elaborated by Krishna later on in the section 31 to 38. He says, you will be infamous. You are famous as a heroic warrior, but if you leave the battlefield, people will think that you are cowardly. You got suddenly got nerves and you left. So suppose there is a final over to be bowled, and there is a famous bowler. No, he is known to bowl well, but there are only, say, 7-8 runs to be scored in that last over. And the bowler says, if I bowl and the batsman scores the 7-8 runs, then my name will get tainted. Oh, that he bowled the last over because we lost the match. And he says, I will not bowl the over only. And people say, you are a chicken. You know, you should be worthy. You should be ready to bowl the over. It is tough, but you have to do it. So like that, if somebody runs away when there is a big crisis, then what happens is, when a person runs away like that, when there is a challenge or a crisis, then the person is disregarded. So this is worse than that. You know, there is a war is there and somebody just leaves the war. He says, you will be treated as cowardly. Akirtikaram Arjuna. So Krishna continues this logic. Srila Prabhupada, his whole purport is primarily focused on only one point. His point is, Shri Bhagavan Vacha. So he says, who is this Bhagavan? Prabhupada talks about the absolute truth as three manifestations, Brahman, Paramatma and Bhagavan. And Bhagavan is the highest manifestation. And Krishna is that Bhagavan. And Prabhupada quotes, from the Bhagavatam twice to establish substantiate this point, how Krishna is the original manifestation of Bhagavan, is the fullest manifestation. Ite chamsha vamsa Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. And that after that, Prabhupada just quotes one paragraph about Kutaha and how this is unworthy action. Then let's look at 2.3. Klaibhyam Masmagamaha Partha Naitatvayupapadyate Shudram Hriday Daurbalyam Tyaktvotishta Parantapa Klaibhyam Masmagamaha Partha. Oh Arjuna, this is Klaibhya. Klaibhya is actually a very strong word. Klaibhya is importance. So it is. This is like a verbal slap for Arjuna. It is a physical slap and it is a verbal slap. So Klaibhyam Masmagamaha Partha. Oh Arjuna, do not become important like this. Naitattvai upapadyate. This does not befit you. Uttvai upapadyate. Upapadyate means to befit you, behoo you. Shudram hrudaya daurbalyam. This is weakness of the heart and this befits a shudra. Tyaktvotishta parantapa. Oh, you are a chastiser of the enemy. The word parantapa will come again and again in the Bhagavad Gita. When a person is to be glorified in praise, you are parantapa. Actually, you are meant to chastise the enemies. But if you flee away from the battlefield, it's unworthy of you. So actually, there are two strong verbal slaps. Well, the Shudra and Klaibhya. So, a man, actually a Kshatriya. Kshatriya is a very, in many ways, the Kshatriya is the personification of masculinity. You know, the Kshatriya is considered to be very, very strong and powerful, virile. And along with that, the Kshatriya is said to have not only courage, but also potency. Kshatriyas have sometimes many wives, and then they beget many children to those wives. So that is considered potency. So of course, Kshatriyas have many wives because in the Vedic culture, women, the male population would often be less than the females, because many men would take sannyas, and that's why all the women had to be married. So Kshatriyas would have many wives sometimes. But the important point is, for a Kshatriya to be considered important is a big, big insult. And for a Kshatriya to be called a Shudra, that is also a big insult. So, this is not just against a casteist insult. It is basically a quality-based insult. Now, somebody who is a very talented student, and so that person is very intelligent, is a topper, and then somebody says, hey, you are a buff, you know, you are a fool, you don't understand anything. That's an insult. It's not a casteist insult, it's a quality-based. You know, somebody has qualities, but when somebody says, you don't have those qualities. So, Krishna is trying to prod Arjuna into action by giving a pep talk over here. And pep talk involves, you know, come on, do it, man. You are not a coward. You are a strong person. Why are you acting cowardly? So, here Krishna is just trying to, through a pep talk, inspire Arjuna to start acting again. So, now, actually speaking, the word Klaibhya brings back memories. Memories that are quite mortifying. Why? Arjuna, as I said, Kshatriya is a very personification of masculinity and virility. So for Arjuna to be Arjuna during the Ajnatvas, he had become Brihanalla. Brihanalla was a dance teacher. So actually, Arjuna had, there was very difficult for Arjuna to conceal himself because he was so famous. But they all had to stay in Ajnatvas. And when Duryodhana set up that condition, Duryodhana was convinced that actually it will be impossible for the Pandavas to hide themselves. My spies will find, and then the condition was if you are found, it will go again for 12 years to the forest. So that way, he thought that he would send them to the forest forever. But Arjuna had taken on the dress of a dance teacher. So he had a very formidable body, which he could not hide. But then, how could he be a dance teacher? So he said he could not very well become a female. So he had the idea that he was a neuter, a eunuch. So actually, how could a person like Arjuna be a eunuch? He was, as I said, such a strong, virile, masculine Kshatriya. So there is the whole story that Arjuna had gone to the heavens. When he was in the heavens, even at time, he was with Indra. Indra was very happy to see, in a sense, Indra was Arjuna's father, because he had been begotten through Indra and Kunti. So Indra welcomed his son, and so Arjuna did heroic feats in Indra's service. There were demons like Nivat Kavachas who had been troubling Indra for a long time, and Arjuna went and single-handedly fought them. And Indra was so confident that Arjuna will be able to kill them And Indra gave his own chariot, Maithili. It was a great honor to get the chariot of Indra. So that honor was also accorded to Lord Ram during the final fight with Ravana. So Indra got Maithili, the chariot here, and the chariot. And then they went and fought, and Arjuna overcame the full gigantic army of the Nivadkavachas. So that Arjuna's exploits when he had gone to heaven are extraordinary. But anyway, when he was in heaven, at that time Indra was giving him a lot of honor. And Indra had these damsels, apsaras, who would dance in his court for his pleasure. And Indra and Arjuna saw over there Urvashi. And he was glancing at her again and again. So actually, Indra immediately noticed it. So Indra thought maybe Arjuna is attracted to Urvashi. So he told Urvashi, you go and serve in Arjuna. So Urvashi dressed herself very nicely. Urvashi, she was also attracted to Indra. Arjuna was very handsome, very powerful. So she went at night to him. And she was dressed in a way that was meant to provoke a man's desires. And when Arjuna saw her, Arjuna immediately, he looked at she was in a particular place, he looked away from her and he says, how can I serve you? He says, Indra has sent me to you. And she basically offered herself to him. And he says, no, actually I was looking at you, but because I have heard about how my ancestor, Pururava, was attracted to you. That story is described in the 9th canto of Bhagavatam and the 11th canto of Bhagavatam. That Pururava was completely infatuated by her and he was practically gave up everything for her sake. So he says, I was remembering about how Pururava was attracted to you and therefore I was looking at you. He says, not that I am personally attracted. He says, no, but he says, I'm attracted to you. Urvashi said, practically speaking, I want to be with you. He says, no, you have been the wife of my ancestor, so therefore you are like my mother. He said, I cannot unite with you. He said, these rules of morality do not apply to us in heaven. He says, no, yes, they may not apply to you in heaven, but I am not from heaven, I am from the earth. I had to follow the rules of morality. He said, no, your father has sent me to you, Indra has sent me to you, you must satisfy me. He said, no, I cannot do that. So, for a woman to offer herself, that is often sometimes difficult to do. And then for a woman to be rejected after she's offered, that is extremely mortifying. So Urvashi was furious. And she said, you are acting like an important person. I curse you that you will become important. Now, for Arjuna, this was devastating. First of all, to exhibit self-control in such a situation where not just an ordinary woman, but apsara is offering herself with no strings attached. That itself is difficult. And after one does that, after one exhibits such exemplary self-control, then instead of being praised, one gets cursed for that. That's even more shocking. So he immediately went to Indra's palace and he told all this. And then Indra said, Indra, he thought, as he was going along the distance, he said, surely Indra must have thought that this will happen. Why did he send? Then Indra told him, don't worry, this will come to good use for you in future. So that curse which Urvashi had given to him when Arjuna had been in heaven in the forest time, so that curse Arjuna used now. So he got the benefit here, because here he wanted to act like a dance teacher for Uttara, the daughter of Virata's king. So then he was able to take up that curse and he acted as a eunuch over here. And in that way, he could also stay in Agyatvas. So actually, sometimes when we try to stay strong in our principles, it may appear as if you are getting into more trouble. By resisting temptation, Arjuna seemed to get into more trouble. But what happened was, eventually, in an inconceivable way, he could not have possibly thought later that I'll have to act like a eunuch and that time the curse will come in helpful. But in the own way, if somebody lives for dharma, even if there is trouble, that trouble will eventually lead to something good in a way that we can't conceive at that time. So that's how Arjuna had acted as a eunuch, and not just acted as a eunuch, he had become a eunuch for that 1 month. He had become physically important. So when he came along, the king of Virat, he actually saw him and when he told that I'm a dance teacher, then he was going to entrust his daughter, so he had to be careful. So he had him examined. And they found that, yes, he is actually a eunuch. And then they had him entrusted with the responsibility of teaching his daughter. So the point of all the discussion is, even if, although Arjuna was a eunuch at that time, but for all the Pandavas, it was an extremely mortifying period. You know, at least when they were in the forest, they were on their own. And they were surrounded by sages and they were discussing Krishna. They were discussing about the various Vedic histories and the Lord's pastimes. But here, when they were Ajnatvas, they had to act as servants for some other king, whose power was actually far lower than their power. So Bhima had to become a cook. Arjuna, Krishna, Yudhishthira became a minister. Draupadi had to become a maid servant for the queen. But among all of them, you know, probably the most mortifying, most humiliating, in a sense degrading duty was for Arjuna. That he had to become a, he had to become a eunuch and a dance teacher for a woman. So of course that that woman was the princess, so that was different. But the point is, for him to become a dance teacher and a eunuch was itself quite mortifying. So the word klaibya actually invokes those thoughts. So for Arjuna, you acted like a klaibya, you acted like a eunuch, you acted like an impotent, but have you actually become important? Have you actually become important? So this is like a severe verbal slap. And Arjuna, Krishna wants to goad Arjuna out and make him fight. But Arjuna's depression is too deep. You know, just some surface talks are not going to work. So Arjuna counters all this. And then Krishna, next time when he speaks, then he will start giving enlightenment. So, let us see what Krishna speaks. Krishna has spoken. Let us see what Arjuna speaks. Arjuna uvacha katham bhishmamaham sankhe dronam cha madhusudana ishu bhi pratiyotsyami pujaravari sudana. So, he says, katham bhishma maham sankhe, in the battle, sankhe, katham bhishma, how can I fight with Bhishma? Dronam cha madhusudana, how can I fight with Drona? The Bhishma is my grandfather, Drona is my teacher. Ishu bhi pratiyotsyami pujaravari sudana, how can I shoot arrows at them? Ishu bhi. So what should I be doing? Actually, instead of offering arrows, pujarav, I should be offering them flowers. I should be respecting them. And he is drawing out, highlighting the contrast by using the word Arisudana. Arisudana means, first he has used the word Madhusudana for him. That is, fine, you are the killer of the Madhu demon. But he is saying, Arisudana, you are the killer of demons. Now, would you ever shoot arrows at Maharaj Ugrasen, who is your grandfather? Or would you shoot arrows at Sandipani Muni, who is your teacher? If you would never shoot arrows at them, you will kill only your demons. You are a killer of enemies, Arisudana. An example of that is you kill Madhu. But how can you ask me to kill, to shoot arrows for killing my elders? In fact, according to Prabhupada, right, according to Vedic etiquette, one should not even verbally counter one's elders. So what to speak of? Physically attack them. So he says, how can I do that? Katham Bhishma. So here they are both discussing in rhetorical language. So Krishna was kutastva kashmalamidam. From where from? From where from have such impurities come? Now, where from such impurities have come doesn't mean have they come from north, west, east, south. That is not the point. They are not expected to be there. It's a rhetorical question. Rhetorical question means, in that the rhetorical question, the answer is implied. The question itself contains an answer. One is not expecting an answer, but it is implied. What is the use of crying when things have already gone wrong? So then, when what is the use of crying means, there is no use of crying. So, kutastva kashmalamidam, from where have they come? They should not have come. Katham bhishma maham sankhe, how can I fight with my elders? That means I cannot fight. So, they are rhetorical questions which are used to emphatically drive home a point. So, then he substantiates this point with further reasoning. Guru nahatva hi mahanubhavan shriyo bhoktum bhaiksham api haloke hatvartha kamamst guru nihaiva munjiye bhogan rudhir pradikdan. So, guru ahatva. So, guru ahatva is to kill, ahatva is to not kill. So, guru ahatva, without killing my little mahanubhavan, and they are mahanubhavan. Now, somebody may say that actually, Yes, he might have been a guru, but he has not acted properly, and therefore is no longer the guru. So the Mahabharata also contains a verse actually, that in the, that if a guru acts in an unworthy way, then the guru can be rejected. So Ruchi Goswami also talks about this in his writings, and we have the example of that in Bali Maharaj acting against the will of Shukracharya. He was a priest, but the priest was also acting like a spiritual master for Bali Maharaj and the demons. So when he told him, don't surrender to Vishnu, so that Bali Maharaj said, no, the purpose of the guru is to help a disciple surrender to Vishnu, to go closer to Vishnu. So if the guru is coming in between that, then the guru should be rejected. So similarly, in this context here, Dronacharya and Bhishma both actually had remained silent. They had not stopped when Draupadi was being disrobed. So by thus allowing adharma to happen, they had also practiced adharma. And because they had practiced adharma, they had also become contaminated by sin. And therefore, they were not worthy of being gurus. So that's why somebody may say that, oh, how can they be killed? So Krishna, Arjuna's point is, no, they are still Mahanubhava. You know, they're still great souls. So, now this Draupadi Swayam, Draupadi's Vastraharan is a very traumatic pastime. Of course, it is dramatic ultimately because Krishna comes and offers unlimited cloth to her. But before that, it was very traumatic. It was traumatic for everyone over there, especially those who are on the side of virtue. So for the Pandavas, it was traumatic to first of all lose their whole kingdom, to lose their honor, to become enslaved, and then to see Draupadi also humiliated like that. But it was similarly for Bhishma also, for Drona also, for all Vidura also. So, and of course, for Draupadi it was so mortifying. So, why did Bhishma remain silent at that time? So, at the deepest level, we understand that this whole pastime is meant to demonstrate a particular truth. And that truth is that no matter how many worthy protectors we have in this world, still, this world can put us in situations where none of our protectors will be able to protect us. And ultimately, we have only one protector. And that protector is the Supreme Lord. So Draupadi had, normally a woman is protected by the husband. Draupadi had 5 Kshatriya husbands. And still she could not be protected. Such circumstances came up that they were all reduced to helplessness. And similarly, there were elders who could not, like Bhishma was so powerful that nobody could counter him in war. Drona was the teacher of great Kshatriyas, and even they were not able to help. So ultimately, we understand this whole pastime is orchestrated in such a way that this lesson is taught, that we have no protector ultimately except Krishna. So that is the lesson which we learn from this pastime at an ultimate level. At the same time, if you look at the contextual level, the Mahabharata especially can be understood at various levels, at the Karmakanda level and the pure devotional level. So at the Karmakanda level, it is why did Bhishma fight on the side of the Kauravas? Because he was duty bound, he had taken a vow. Because he had taken the salt of the Kauravas, so he had to fight on their side. He had taken a vow to protect the ruling dynasty, ruler of the Hastinapur. And that's why he had to fight. But that is external reason. That is the Karmakanda level. A deeper level, he fought on the side of the Kauravas because he wanted to demonstrate the principle that the Lord wanted through him to demonstrate the principle that anybody who goes against the will of the Lord, that person will perish. So similarly, at the Karmakanda level, at the pure devotional level, we understand that Bhishma Pitama was orchestrated by the Lord. But at another level, at the Karmakanda level, we can also look at the reasoning. So, when Draupadi was gambled and she was lost, so at that time, Duryodhana, Karna, Dushyasana, they all started laughing, rubbing salt on the wounds of the Kauravas, of the Pandavas. And then they suggested, now Draupadi has been won over, now let us bring her over here. Bring her here and then she is our maid servant. We can do whatever we want with her. Actually, even with paid servants, Kshatriyas are not allowed to do anything that they want. Then they have to, maid servants also will be taken care of. Kshatriyas, Kshatatrayate, they are meant to protect others. These maid servants are meant to serve in the serve the house and serve the kings, but they also should be given proper dignity. This was the idea. She's our maid servant, you can do whatever you want. This was a perversion of Kshatriya idea, and worse, all the more so for a woman who is not a maid servant. So then he sent one of the court attendants, it's called Pratikamin. So Pratikamin, he said, go and get Draupadi. So now he was trembling. You know, he knew this was a very adharmic act that was happening. When he told Draupadi, Draupadi was very kind, and he said, what is the matter? He said, you have been summoned to the assembly. And he told everything that happened. So Draupadi was aghast to hear this. But then she said that you go and ask the assembly that who was gambled first. If Yudhishthir had gambled himself away first, then did he have any right to gamble me? You know, if Yudhishthir was not even his own master, he was already a slave, he was already lost himself, he had become a slave, then how could he have gambled me? And if he was not my master and he has gambled me at that time, then then my gambling is not proper, then I am not anybody's slave. So she went and he went and told this. So the Pratikamin said this question, and then Duryodhana just, he was so hofty, he said, you know, tell her she can come to the assembly and ask this question to the assembly herself. So Pratikamin went again, and then she said, Draupadi heard this and she said, actually I'm in my period, I'm wearing a single cloth, I cannot come now. So he went and told Duryodhana got very angry, why are you coming alone? So he said, our answer, she cannot come. So then Duryodhana says, she's our maid servant, whether she's in a period or what, she is wearing a single cloth or no cloth, she has to obey our commands. He says, Duryodhana turned to Dushyasana. He said, you know, this Pratikamin is a coward, he's afraid of Bhima. Dushyasana, you are not afraid of Bhima, you go and get her. So then Dushyasana went and brutally dragged her. So when Draupadi saw Dushyasana coming, she became scared and she ran. She only place she could run to was, everybody was in the assembly, so she ran towards Gandhari's chambers. So at least Gandhari would stop her. But before she could reach Gandhari's chambers, Dushyasana grabbed her, caught her by her hair and dragged her brutally to the assembly. And crying bitterly like a helpless osprey, Draupadi came and fell. He was thrown, hurled on the floor on the of the court. And everybody was aghast. Of course, everybody apart from the Kauravas, they were aghast to see what was happening. Fie. They said, this is terrible. They said, what is this happening? But then Draupadi got up and she says, she was such a cultured lady. She says, please forgive me, I am coming in this condition, but I have been brought here against my will. And she submitted the same appeal again. And she looked at everyone else, at everyone. And nobody answered her. So then, at that time, when nobody answered, she begged, she said, you know, please tell. Now, actually, the Pandavas were so mortified, they could not even meet the eyes of Draupadi. And Draupadi said that, please tell, actually if Yudhishthir has already gambled himself, then how could he have gambled me? So then, at that time, Bhishma Pitama, he's Pope, and Bhishma said that actually, the question that you asked is very difficult. Now my mind is bewildered. He said that, you know, actually, if a person has gambled himself away, then he has no right to gamble anyone else. But at the same time, it is said that, the scripture that, the wife is always belongs to the husband. So, these are contradictory considerations and I don't know. I am confused about what is the solution. So, here, actually from the Karmakanda point of view, here Bhishma Pitama is acting as if he is caught in a Niyamagraha. We discussed in Upadesha Amrut. Niyamagraha means to get caught in the technicalities of a rule without understanding its essential principle. So the essential principle is that all the rules are ultimately there to prevent injustice from happening. And now, at a blatant level, injustice is happening. How? You know, a virtuous lady is being so publicly and flagrantly dishonored. That's injustice. So technicalities don't matter, you know. The whole thing should have been stamped right away, there itself. But here what happens is Vishwamitama gets caught in the Niyamagraha. And then Vikarna speaks. And Vikarna says, oh, assembly, you should answer. He says, if you are not going to answer, nobody answers the question. She has raised a question and we will all become contaminated by sin if we don't answer. Then Vikarna says, if you don't answer, I will answer. And then Vikarna says that when Kshatriyas come under the influence of animal hunting, womanizing, gambling or drinking, then they lose their intelligence and they act irrationally. And what action are done in that situation should not be taken very seriously. So he says that I feel that whole gambling match should be cancelled, annulled. And the Pandavas should be restored to their kingdom and Draupadi should be restored to her proper honor. So on hearing this, all the assemblies except for the Kauravas start cheering. And they all start cheering. Yes, it's very rightly said, very rightly said. But then Karna blazes up. And he, moving his giant arms, he silences everyone. Shut up, he says. And then he says that there are many improper things that I have seen in this assembly. But the most improper thing is what Vikarna has spoken. See his perverted logic. Vikarna is trying to protect Dharma, but he's saying this is the most improper thing I said. He says Yudhishthir gambled voluntarily. He says nobody forced him to gamble. He was invited, he came. He was invited to gamble, he agreed to gamble. Nobody forced him to gamble his kingdom. Nobody forced him to gamble himself. Nobody forced him to gamble his wife. He has gambled voluntarily. So now he has to bear the consequence. And as far as chastity is concerned, actually, what kind of chaste woman will marry five husbands? Now, she is not at all a chaste woman. And whatever we do to her, we say that there's nothing wrong with it. Because a woman who has five husbands, she's already unchaste. So when Karna spoke to the Pandava, he became so angry. That was the time soon after that Bhima took off. Those fierce vow. He took the vow that Dushyasana had brought Draupadi with her hand, dragging with her hand. He said, I'll cut off that hand and I'll drink the blood. And Duryodhana had said, oh, Draupadi, you are my maid servant, come and sit on my lap now. So he had tapped his lap. So I told him, I'll break your thigh. Bhima took that vow. So Arjuna said, I'll kill Karna. So it's a very terrible occasion. So of course, the point of our discussion here is that Maunam Sammati Lakshanam. Bhishma and Drona, they were in that assembly, and while being in that assembly, they silently, almost unprotestingly, allowed Draupadi to be disgraced. So that's why they are not worthy to be gurus. That is the point. But Arjuna feels, no, they have given me so much. They are worthy of being gurus. Gurun ahatva hi mahanubhava. So they are still mahanubhava. Shreyo bhoktum bhaiksham api haloke. So he says that rather than trying to enjoy this world, bhaiksham, literally better, shreya for me if I become a beggar. And I live by begging rather than hatvartha kamamstu gurun ihaiva, for my kama, for my lust, hatvartha, if I kill my worshipable superiors, bhunjiya bhogan rudhir pradigdan, then the spoils that we get, the kingdom that we'll get, will be tainted by blood. And what is the use of such kingdom that is tainted by blood? He says, we'll be contaminated by sin, we'll be tainted by blood. So far better than that is shreyo bhoktum bhaiksham. It is far better to live by begging. So Arjuna, he is maintaining his respect towards his superiors, even though they have acted in grievously wrong ways. And he's saying, I cannot kill them. Better that I live by begging. Why live by begging? Because for a Kshatriya, there is no other way to live. Kshatriya is meant to rule, and that way Kshatriya gains taxes, and that's how the Kshatriya rules. The Pandavas living in of exile in the forest, that was exceptional situation because they were under sentence. And when they were living as guests after that in Virat's kingdom, that is also as temporarily. But normally Kshatriyas need to have a place to administer, and that's how they live. Otherwise, they basically are renunciates. And as renunciates, they live by begging. So he says, it is better for us to live by begging. It's better for us to live that way rather than to eat the spoils of those who have been killed. So this is Arjuna's feeling, and we will discuss this more in our next class. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai.